Hey folks, Tyler with Being This Person here. And this is an episode I did with a very insightful, witty, and talented comedian that I met around town. The episode does come with a surprise. I did ask him to bring his ukulele, but there's a little bit of a spoiler for a spoiler. I think you'll enjoy it, and I think you'll enjoy the surprise too. And I would encourage you to go see him if you see him coming locally to you. He's a pretty dang funny guy, and it was a great guy to talk to. He had a lot of neat things to say and a lot of insight in his life. Anyway, on that note, folks, I hope you would subscribe, rate, and leave good reviews. Ratings also good, of course. And tell a friend, because telling a friend really does a lot more than even the ratings or reviews. But those are the way that the internet works, and people get to see us and find us. And it gets other people listening, because apparently you like it, and I appreciate that. You can email us at beingthisperson.com, all lowercase letters, no spaces. We are easily found as Being This Person on Facebook. You can email us at beingthisperson@gmail.com. I'm going to get it straight sooner or later. And easily found on Facebook at Being This Person. We do have a website, beingthisperson.com. Again, all lowercase, no spaces. I do have a Twitter that I'm using to put a little stuff out there. It is at @DONESTYLER. Capitalize the D and the T and all of that. And you should be able to find me out there on Twitter. You might be able to dig it up through Being This Person. I'm getting that all figured out. At this point, folks, thank you very much for listening. And let's roll the theme music. And the first question, who are you?
I am actually three cats in a trench coat.
I didn't know what I was getting into.
Yeah, no. It's, that's actually a good way of describing me. No, I am Alex Milstein. I am a lot of things. I am a musical comedian and I guess as of right now, a bureaucrat. But, that's just kind of like who I am as a profession.
A bureaucrat?
Yeah.
Profession?
Yeah, no, I'm, right now I'm currently working for the University of Oregon Department of Parking and Transportation. I work in the kiosk, and it's a entryway job, and then I hope to go more into, you know, Office Specialist 1, Office Specialist 2, assuming stand-up doesn't work out.
That is straight up the bureaucracy.
Well defined. Yeah. Originally, I was thinking about becoming a lawyer. Which that whole idea of that profession used to really dominate my personality until I realized I didn't want to be a lawyer. My dad wanted me to be a lawyer. And so then I was just like, well, I have this degree in political science and history. Might as well just become a bureaucrat and that'll work.
Right. You kind of fit. Was your dad a lawyer?
He was a engineer at Intel. I don't know what he's doing now. Last I heard, he had lost his job. I don't talk to my dad that much. He's not exactly a great person. That's a good way of answering who am I. I used to be what my dad wanted me to be until I discovered that I could be my own person. And then I kind of broke off from that, and I'm still kind of figuring out who I am. But at the moment, three cats in a trench coat.
I like three cats in a trench coat.
Yeah, no, it's perfect because I absolutely love cats and I'm kind of all over the place, but when I need to be, I can get focused and hunt.
And cat was the very first thing we talked about when you walked up to my porch.
Yeah. Oh yeah, 10 minutes, yeah. Which is a great name for a catty. He looks great. He was offering me, it's a him, right?
Yes.
He was offering me his belly, which I kind of took, but I was just like, oh, you're going to trap me soon, aren't you?
Well, yeah, the warning. Like, he's friendly until he's not.
Yeah.
He's that cat. How many cats do you have?
I currently zero, which is unfortunate because my place, I currently can't get cats. But I will walk around the neighborhood and just pet cats, and I kind of like, I've met various
borrow cats.
Yeah. No, it's actually, cats are a huge part of my life. My current girlfriend, the main thing we do all day is we literally just find pictures of cats on the internet and send them to one another. And that's like, you know, at least 10 to 15 pictures a day, if not more, between the two of us. And then...
Like, that's a trope in the internet.
Yeah.
People in cat pictures. You're actually one of the people with cat pictures. That's awesome.
Yeah, but they're not even my cat. I just kind of collect them and then send them because I'm like, oh, it's so cute, or oh, this is so funny. And that's it. And that's like a big part of my life. And I'm really looking forward to one day owning a cat. And I just need to, you know, that's when my girlfriend and I will move in together. We'll get a cat. That's probably going to be like the first thing we do. But until then, I walk around petting various neighborhood sweethearts.
I love that approach. That's awesome.
Yeah.
But you're right. It sounds like you're in a growth phase and you're just going to grow into the position where you can do that.
Yeah. Well, I also think that you always grow. Like, if you're not growing and you're like, oh, this is who I am, that's generally like a bad thing. I mean, yeah, like you want to have some definitive traits, but I think I would like to be someone who is constantly growing and never like, there's never like a finish. It's just more of like a morphing kind of like, if like there was a statue that was just constantly changing shape and color, with like, there's no definitive like end for it.
I like that idea too. But it's kind of the permanently molding clay model that just because you've grown this far and, yes, established, as you said, some definitive traits, or I think is close to the words you used, doesn't mean you're stuck in your ways and you can't still adapt and learn and change and, as we were saying, grow.
Yeah. But for more hardline things, because there is... I'm kind of an odd person in that... I'm not odd. Scratch that. I'm a person that is, you know, will, like, lose focus, wander around, and just kind of, like, expand a whole bunch, and then all of a sudden just focus and be really sharp on the focusness. Focusness is not a word.
It is now.
Focal point. Focal. Yeah. I'm kind of doing the whole, like, wandering thing.
Like the next interest that you catch that really grabs you? Is that
that's correct. Generally, what my entire life has been is just me being like, oh, this would be a cool idea. Oh, this would be a cool idea. And then finding something that I actually really like and then just, like, hitting it as hard as I can. There have been a few constants in my life. Cats is one of them. As being, you know, three cats in a trench coat, it's very important to me. And then comedy has always been the other kind of constant. I have been unable to escape it, no matter what I do, even if I try to make serious.
How long have you been doing it? Because I know you self-define as a musical comedian.
Yes.
But you just recently, through social media, posted some work you did before you were a musical comedian.
Yes.
So you've obviously been at it a while.
I officially started when I was 13 years old. Doing improv comedy. Yeah. The way I got into that was my parents had just gotten divorced. My mom had joined a improv comedy troupe, and they had a kids program, and she took me to that, and I really thrived in that. The way I got into stand-up is, at around 15, she took me to an open mic, and I saw it, and I thought, I could do better. And then I went and I wrote, like, 5 minutes, and then I went and I did an open mic at the improv club. For, like, a crowd of, like, 100 people. And that's not, like, an exaggeration. That is, like, a literal count.
It was a really... Where?
Comedy Sports Portland.
Okay.
They no longer have a stand-up open mic. This was back in, like, 2010, 2011, when Portland didn't exactly have a comedy scene.
There was a flat spot in the comedy world. I mean, comedy's in a boom right now, which is awesome.
But that's back when there were, like, three comedy places, and Comedy Sports just happened to be where, for some reason, a lot of people really wanted to go for an open mic, so.
That's a huge crowd for your first, especially your first five.
Right? Oh, yeah. It was great. I loved the feeling I got from it. And then being a stand-up comedian kind of took over my identity. And I just wanted to be, oh, look, at high school, I just wanted to be, oh, look, I'm the stand-up comic guy. I think a lot of my life has always been trying to, like, force myself into a label that defines me, which I think was why I'm so now of, oh, I do not want a label. I have been there. I've done that. No, get me away from that. It is such a terrible idea. Just to, like, say, oh, I am defined by this exactly one thing. I only exist in this one definition. Which is how I live my life. I used to define myself as, oh, I'm the Jew kid at school. Everything I do needs to be, like, revolved around my Jewiness.
Are you religiously Jewish as well as by birth? Because Judaism is weird.
Yeah.
You can be born into it, but not necessarily religious in it. And you can be religious in it, but not necessarily born into it. And it's like...
Yeah. I am ethnic. I don't practice it religiously, but I'm definitely ethnic. Okay. No matter what I can say, I will never not be a Jew. Because it's just... it's blood-related at this point. And so, yeah, I did stand-up from 15 to 18. At the same time, I was also doing comic strips and writing comic books, all of which are also humorously themed. It was... I don't know why I never tried to do something serious or dramatic. I think even if I did, it always just turned out to be funny, and the funny parts were always the best. I remember I drew a comic when I was 14 called Yiddish Man the Super Jew, which... And his whole thing is...
Right, that's funny.
Yeah. He had the power of 1,000 doctors, 1,000 lawyers, and 1,000 bankers. This was incredibly self-anti-Semitic.
You know what, like the sophomore in high school or something? Like that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh my gosh, this is great.
Incredibly poorly drawn, but it was derived from just like how Jews were perceived in the media and the fact that I just really craved some sort of identity. And then I thought, oh, this is kind of funny, which it was, but, you know... It wasn't even playfully anti-Semitic. It was just very anti-Semitic. And there were... at 14 years old, I didn't exactly understand what racism was. So there's a lot of...
Racism at that time was identified a little differently. I mean, like, yeah. It's progressing a lot right now. It's a really big social movement right now, and I'm really glad to see it, frankly. But at the same time, when you're that age, like, you don't necessarily have a grasp on where the limits and levels are.
Yeah. Do you want to hear the plot of the first issue? Because it's
absolutely
it's terrible.
Let's fucking do this.
Okay, so the plot of the first thing is someone has mysteriously shut down all the power in New York, and people are super bored, so they start having a bunch of sex, and which causes a rise in babies to be had. And Yiddish Band is tasked with finding out who's been doing this, and. It is the president of a diaper company who's shutting off the power so that more babies are born so that they can sell diapers. The CEO is a black woman, and the way Yiddish Man beats her is I think he, like, threatens to close KFC out of business. Because I remember when I said it was going to be racist, and then I did not have a grasp of racism.
Well, you get the I was young and didn't know what was going on card totally.
Yeah.
Wow. That's stunning. That's super.
Yeah,
great.
And so that was the plot of the first Yiddish Man the Super Jew. There was a whole bunch of other anti-Semitic jokes, and I'm pretty sure I threw in a red herring, but Lord, I do not remember it. And I don't even know if I can find the old comics. But that's what I remember from Yiddish Man the Super Jew.
That's pretty hilarious. What a way to start.
Yeah.
Well, what a way to self-identify too. I mean, because you're identifying with your ethnicity through that. Yeah.
Oh, the other thing I identified with was comics. I loved the funny pages. I loved Archie Comics. I worshipped Archie Comics and Mad Magazine growing up. I loved them so much. And a big part of me really wanted to be a cartoonist. I just really couldn't draw. So, which is why I was like, oh, I'll just be a newspaper comic strip artist.
Neither can Pissarro, frankly. But he's one of the best of all time. It's funny because Mad Magazine and Archie... They were an American institution before I was born.
Yeah.
You know?
No one... I could talk to no one about that. No one in high school knew about Archie. No one in high school knew about Mad Magazine. It was just like... It was kind of my own thing. And it sucked because there was no one really to talk to about it. people didn't even, I couldn't even really find anyone to talk just about like comic books or comic culture in high school for some reason. It was before it was like super mainstream and like cool to do.
Well, there's all the movies now which make it that way. But I remember even when I was in high school, it was definitely a thing. I mean, there were still definitely collectors.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran on the fringe of that. I got a couple here and there. I got into some weird indie darker comics like the Crow comics and things like that.
Right.
First movie wasn't a bad depiction of the storyline. After that,
yeah.
But so I mean, there was a niche, but at the same time, you're right. It was hard to find anybody to communicate that entertainment or that enjoyment with because it was so niche.
Yeah. Speaking of Crow, it just reminded me of something else because there was a wrestler named Sting who modeled part of his gimmick after the Crow.
Really?
Yeah, he wore the Crow makeup and he would like lurk in the balcony and like, you know, pop out of nowhere and hit people with baseball bats. It's professional wrestling, and that was like that was back in the 90s when professional wrestling was kind of like incredibly unhinged.
Yes.
But what that reminded me of was I was super into wrestling growing up, and all my friends were like, oh, you're dumb for liking wrestling. And so I kind of suppressed it. And it wasn't until recently that I was like, oh, wrestling's really cool. I should watch it. Which made me finally figure out the answer to who am I? I'm someone who doesn't really live with any more shame, and I just kind of do what I like to do and do what I love to do. And that is the answer to that question.
Way to bring it around.
Thank you.
That was stunning. That was really well done.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I
think we're just going to move on to question two.
All right.
Because that was just, when you nail it, go on. So the next question, which they always lead into each other all of
sure.
The next question is why? Why are you you are? Why are you a person who lives with no shame any longer?
I am a person who doesn't really live with shame because I realized that doing something that I don't want to do just because it makes me look cool or more powerful is incredibly pointless. Like, the idea of just upholding yourself to an image for other people is stupid. I just want to be comfortable.
I think it's even worse than stupid. I think it's self-damaging.
Yeah.
Frankly.
This came from... I mean, I guess there's no really way to avoid not talking about my dad. This came from the fact that my dad tried to mold me into the person he wanted me to become. And for a long time, I adhered to that, and I was very much under his thumb. I was very much being manipulated by him. And it wasn't until moving away to go to college that I started to kind of poke out and realize, hey, that this isn't quite right. And I had a very negative reaction to all this. Lots of suicidal thoughts, lots of suicidal attempts, because I was trying to force myself into something that I wasn't. And it was through lots of therapy and lots of, you know, self-realization that I realized, I should just be comfortable. I just want to be comfortable. And that's kind of how I broke out of it. I think I'm like in the second year of this. I didn't realize all this until I was like really 21. And then there was a whole bunch of other things I had to go through before I'm like, even at the point where I am now.
Once you break the seal.
Yeah.
I mean, like, things stack up and move through really quickly and forcefully sometimes. I've self-identified pretty well from a much younger age than a lot of people, but I also did it at a slower pace. I didn't go erratically in a lot of directions. I just kind of stayed the clear path all the way along. But there are definite times when just a breakthrough and you're flooded and it's not particularly easy to deal with all that new stuff. It's exciting.
Yeah. What really got, and it wasn't just my dad, it was also like, you know, the whole societal expectation of what it is to be like a guy, to be masculine, and kind of realizing that that was not exactly who I was and kind of breaking out of that just so I could be comfortable. Like, the stupidest example that I can think of is I would always drink like really, like, you know, nice artisanal coffees and drink them black because I wanted to be seen as, you know, a sophisticated guy with refined taste. Now I just drink whatever's in the office and I just put cream and sugar in it and it's and it is absolutely delicious and I love coffee. But that, but the, is that, that's what I mean, in that, like, you know, I want it, I was kind of being forced into this idea of what I wanted to be and then breaking out and doing what I actually wanted to do, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It does. Putting down the expectations that had been, A, put on you by your parents, mm-hmm. it sounds like, and B...
Just my dad, I should say. My mom is, my mom was very much, hey, you should just go out and experience life and do what you want. I'll be here to support you if you need it. She's awesome.
Those are good.
Yeah.
I got blessed. I have two parents that are pretty much like that.
Oh, that's awesome.
I'm super blessed with parents. They're both really pretty good people. But, so anyhow, back to the breaking out thing. It was moving to college kind of the catalyst?
That was definitely the catalyst. Because I went into college and I didn't have my dad, or I guess some of my high school friends, really just reinforcing, like, the fact that I had to, like, you know, be in this image and I had to be this person. And I think without that kind of reinforcement, I kind of, like, you know, caught a glimpse of myself in the mirror and kind of saw what I was. And, no, that's not exactly quite right. Okay, so the reinforcement into something that I wasn't, that part's correct. Losing the reinforcement definitely allowed me to figure out what I liked. I just can't think of a good metaphor or analogy for it.
I mean, using just regular words, don't have to
sure, yeah.
A metaphor or analogy, really. So just finding that you could free yourself
yes.
is what did it. Like that, realizing that you didn't have to be attached to these things that you were fed and that you had somehow talked yourself into in some ways, it sounds like.
Yeah, that sounds correct.
That I'm trying to paraphrase to make sure I'm on the same page and present.
Yeah. And it was really just like, I mean, like, because I had to, like, you know, my dad really wanted me to be a lawyer, and I thought that I wanted to be a lawyer. And then I go out and I start doing things to prepare for being a lawyer, and then I'm like, ooh, I really don't want to do these things.
Well, yeah, not to mention, like, $120 billion in student debt.
Yeah, that that too, for, like, a zero, for like a job that doesn't pay as well as it used to. That was one of the other things. The other thing that kind of came up is... I saw my dad in a very different light. I used to think he was a person who could literally make no mistakes. And then I saw he was making a bunch of mistakes. He was being really bad with his money. He was being incredibly irresponsible. And I was just like, maybe I shouldn't be listening to him.
Maybe I need a better leader.
Yeah. This is... he might not be the best person to take advice from. I should say that I wasn't like... A lot of this wasn't, like, me thinking, well, I don't want to be a lawyer, but my dad does. I should not think about that. It wasn't, like, you know, all thought out like that. It was very much, I just got really sad all the time. I thought about killing myself, and then I was just like, well, why am I having these thoughts? Am I not eating correctly? Am I not getting enough sleep? Is there, like, a chemical imbalance? And then it was once I started, like, moving away from my dad and, like, you know, listening to myself rather than him that I just kind of became happier. And now, looking back on it, I can put it into words, but at the time, it was just, like, pure, raw feelings that were just telling me, this is bad, don't do this, you are, ugh.
And so you were, because you were boxed in that situation, that was causing your mental struggles.
Yeah.
And I think that's common for a lot of people. I think a lot of people that are struggling, I mean, there are certainly people with chemical imbalances, and I'm not going to belittle anybody's
sure.
space, but I think a lot of people on the surface are struggling with who they actually are as a person and whether they're true to themselves or not. That's the third one where you've tried to knock over the fan. Quit it. So, I think that's pretty common. And when people find a way to look at who they are and to become more okay with who they are, it does make it easier to work through any other difficulties that you may or may not have.
Yeah.
It's cool to hear that you've done that.
Yeah.
It looks like you're, I mean, you speak about it very excitedly.
Yeah, no, it was, I don't get many chances outside of therapy to really talk about, you know, the progress and journey that I made. So it's nice to be able to talk about it because, I mean, that is basically why I am who I am, because I made like a journey of saying, I don't want to be the person people, my dad and society is forcing me to be. I just kind of want to do what I like. The important thing that I realized is money is not as important as I thought it was going to be. I used to, and this is true, I used to be under the impression that I was going to need to make at least $100,000 a year, otherwise I would be poor. That was directly drilled into my dad.
You build a construct somewhere, yeah. And somehow you teach yourself to believe it.
Yeah. And now I realize, not really. You just cook for yourself, you find a nice place, it's fine.
It works out much easier. Yeah. And not to be said that pretty much everywhere I've always been, I could always have a little bit more money, be a little bit more comfortable. I think there would come a level of this is ludicrous.
Yeah. if you had all the money that you wanted, what would you do? What would you even do?
I've been asked many times in my life what my dream job is, mm-hmm. and it's independently wealthy. That's my dream job.
Nice.
And there'd be a lot of crazy, weird philanthropy. Not like giving to the Dornbeckers, but like some, like be my own Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Oh, that'd be fun.
Kind of thing.
Nice.
And like that, and of course, like I'd have a couple cool cars. I would Jay Leno collection.
Nice.
I'd have a couple of cool cars, you know. And I'd have probably 5 or 10 acres a little bit out of town. Yeah. Instead of living smack in the middle of the town. I mean, I love the convenience of this, but if money wasn't an object.
Yeah.
And I'd just kind of have fun. Probably even try and hold a job. I emphasize the try part, because if you're independently wealthy, your instinct to go, you know what, fuck you.
Yeah, exactly. Leave
is probably going to be a little higher. Like, I could buy you.
Yeah, exactly.
So, that's what I'd do. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very unrealistic thing. I don't ever foresee it happening.
Yeah.
But, you know, God got a dream, right?
Exactly, yeah.
How about you? What would you do?
I mean, the first thing I would do is I would do some traveling. I would do some traveling. I love Japan. I love Japanese culture. I love Japanese comics. I love Japanese food. I would go to Japan and I'd travel there for a long time and probably periodically go back. As for a house, almost similar to what you said, something a little bit out of town. I'd have lots of trees. I'd have like a really nice garden with like a nice little tea area. Lots of cats. we're talking at least 6 or 7 cats. And then I guess I'd be able to, you know, just buy like whole spices in a spice grinder. And that's a big part of it. That'd be great. And then I would use the rest of my... I wouldn't work. I would either think about doing like a Let's Play channel, if you know what that is.
Yeah.
I don't
watch them, but my kid does, so. I understand, yeah.
Maybe like I would just become a Let's Player and just like, you know, play video games and just be like, well, I don't have to like worry about being successful at this, so there's so that.
What does it matter?
Yeah, and then the other one would be just investing in restaurants and just being like, hey, chefs, prepare food, and if I like it, I'll give you enough money and you can start your own restaurant. That'd be fun.
That'd be cool.
I would love to host like cooking competitions and try food and just be like, I'm going to finance your restaurant. Go out, here you go, here's the starting money.
Try your best. TV show style, almost.
Not even reality TV show. Although maybe because that would just get
why the hell
money.
Not?
Yeah. But just eating like lots and lots of food, and like just turning that into a job, I guess would be great.
So you like exotic food? You're kind of a foodie, it sounds like.
No, not really.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no. At the moment. I'm eating a lot of Asian and Japanese cuisine. That's mostly because I just switched to becoming vegetarian, and it's just easier to eat that way.
Like how long ago switched?
A month and a half. So very, like I...
Are you ovo-lacto or have you gone straight vegan?
Ovo-lacto.
Milk and eggs.
Yes, that one. I don't think I can do vegan. I like cheese too much. It is... cheese is so wonderful.
Cheese, you can throw manna from heaven.
Yeah, you can throw cheese into literally everything. I make a thing. This is like one of the laziest dishes ever, but like I take onions, I throw curry spices into it, throw some garlic and ginger in it, and then I throw eggs in it on top of that, and then I throw cheese into that, and I call it egg curry. But it's just like, it's like... I should say the ratio, it's like a 1-to-1 cheese to egg ratio. It's just like a handful of cheese and 2 eggs, and it's just
gooey and yummy.
Oh,
and
it's so good. I tell myself I'm eating eggs, but I'm eating cheese.
Yeah, you are. But I mean, you're getting protein and calcium. They're both required things.
Exactly.
that's awesome. So how, I mean, why vegetarianism? Was it?
Oh, that one, so basically, my girlfriend had been trying to eat vegetarian. She would be, you know, 4 out of 7 days a week, she would eat vegetarian, and sometimes she would just, like, eat meat for one meal of the day. My mom had just become vegetarian. And then I had also heard this story about, like, a tick that if it bites you, you're allergic to meat. And I was thinking to myself, and this was
that
back
supposedly
when
is a thing. Yeah. I mean, I've only seen it on the internet, but, you know.
But I was thinking to myself, if I got bitten by that tick, my life would be over. I would hate life so much because I was eating like a steak for dinner every single night. And then I was just like, well, would it even be that bad? And so then I was just like, all right, I'm going to try to eat vegetarian for 1 week and see how it goes. And it was really just an excuse to eat falafel for lunch every day.
Which is not a bad pursuit, frankly.
Yeah, it was really good. And then I tried it, and I was just like, oh, this is really good. And then all of a sudden, I was like, oh, I feel really, really good all of a sudden. And then I just kept doing it and kept doing it and kept feeling better and kept feeling better and then started losing weight, like, progressively. And I was like, oh, well, this is great, and I really like chickpeas, and now meat tastes weird. And so I just kind of can't go back. I've tried eating meat, like, a couple of weeks ago, and I actually got, like, a little sick. So now I'm just like, I don't actually know if I can go back.
Interesting, because, I mean, most people make a very conscious choice for political reasons or environmental reasons or health reasons or what have you. It sounds like you just kind of stumbled into it.
Yeah, no, I was just like, oh, that sounds fun. I'll do that. It was, my original goal was I'll see how long I can keep this up and hopefully I'll learn how to cook with more vegetables in my life. Because it was something I was doing really, really badly. And now I'm probably just going to do all vegetables all the time for as long as this lasts. I mean, I could always go back to meat.
Nice. That's cool. It's cool, A, that you fell into it, because it's kind of neat. And B, doing it now is much easier than it used to be. I went vegetarian from, like, 89 to 91.5, 92-ish.
Ooh, yeah.
And I almost starved myself, because it was next to nothing available. I was on the road traveling for 1 year out of that. And our meals were planned for us, and the vegetarian options were horrible. Ugh. And then pepperoni pizza, and I caved.
Yeah. Like,
there's just almost nothing better in the world. And it was just very difficult. I've eaten a lot of vegetarians since then. I've dated a lot of vegans and did it a raw foodist talk about really having to pay attention to what you're cooking. You can't even have roasted peppers because roasting is technically cooking. So pepper flakes, red pepper flakes, right out.
Why even have peppers if you're not gonna fry them?
Straight dried, you can do.
Well, no, I'm thinking about taking a bell pepper and like sautéing it because that's fantastic.
I had some in my omelet this morning.
Yeah, that's what got me to become vegetarian. Of just being like, I wonder if peppers are good if you sauté them in butter. And the answer is yes, they're incredibly
almost
good.
Almost everything's good if you sauté it in butter.
Oh yeah.
I want to take a break, get more beverages.
Oh yeah, sure. That sounds good.
Cool. All right, so the next question is, what makes you unique?
I mean, the cheeky answer is my DNA, probably. I'm pretty sure it's one of a kind. I don't know if this is, like, from CSI or, like, if this is a made-up thing, but apparently there's some statistic where it's, like, apparently there's a 1 in a trillion chance that someone will be born, like, as an exact copy of you.
That's something like what I've heard. It's basically, there are 7.5, almost 8 billion people on this planet.
Yeah.
There are the chances of you being very, very similar to somebody are high, just with the numbers.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, like, this is still just similar.
Yeah. I do have one of those looks where it's like, you know, Seth Rogen, Jonah Hill.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's I fall into that category of person where I get people are like, oh, man, you look like – has anyone ever told you you look like Seth Rogen?
Hey.
Yeah, he was probably just like, yeah, you look like Seth Rogen.
And like, one dog's on the other one's bed. Anybody who listens to these two. Yeah.
But, I mean, to answer the question more seriously, what makes me unique? I mean, definitely, like, what I've done. I would definitely say I have a fairly good drive, which I think I would like to think is unique. I will typically, if I want to do something, I typically just, I'm like, all right, time to go out and do it.
How do you approach that? I just did another one recently, and somebody said the same thing. Or similar words, anyhow. But how do you approach to go out and do it? Because
oh, if someone said that, that's not so. I'm not so unique, am I?
Well, no. What we find by listening to lots of them is that there are similarities and uniquenesses in each one, and how people approach it. And I ask because I, if I can, try and find an expert when I'm trying to find out a new skill or something. But frequently, because it's the 21st century, the internet is on at least 4 different devices within our reach right now. So, Google. So, yeah. How do you chase after new pursuits?
I literally am just like, okay, time to do it. And that's not even like an exaggeration. I started playing ukulele because my stepdad brought a ukulele to the beach house, and I was just playing it, and I was playing it, and I'm like, I like playing this. Time to learn how to play ukulele. I go, buy myself a ukulele, and I just practice a bunch. And then I learned ukulele.
Oak's a great one for that, too.
Yeah.
It's pretty easy, comparatively, because, you know, you don't have a giant fretboard. You only have 4 strings you have to deal with. And it's something you can totally just sit back, chill out, and do.
Yeah.
That's kind of what it's built for. My ukulele, I learned by much the same thing. I mean, I have some basic guitar skills, and I just transferred those when I went to Hawaii and decided to bring, that was going to be my souvenir. I was going to buy an ukulele in Hawaii. Because why not, right? That's perfect. And so much the same way. Just kind of fiddled around with it. Definitely not to the level you've gotten.
Yeah.
I poke and prod, and like I said, it has 3 strings. So it's been a while.
Yeah. Another example is in both high school and college, I started a comics-related project. In high school, I started a comics page in the school newspaper, and I became the editor of that. And in college, I created a magazine called Art Deco.
Yeah,
the University of Oregon.
Right, so
Art Deco. And
for those not around here, the duck is the mascot of the University of Oregon.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty good pun.
I was happy with it. And I was just like, all right, there's no place for comics. There's no real space for comics. And I was just like, I'm going to go do that. So I just wrote up a pitch to the guy who ran the comics and cartoons minor program at the University of Oregon saying, hey, I want to do this magazine and I kind of want to run it under your banner. And I pitched it to him and he was like, okay, here's money, have fun. And then I sent out like kind of like a recruitment thing. We started with like a staff of 5 people and then we just started producing magazines. And by the time I was done, we had a staff of 20 people. We produced a magazine 3 times a school year and we had like a $10,000 budget. And I was just like, okay, cool.
Awesome.
And so that's
so you use the production facilities on campus and such, I imagine, for a lot of this?
I mean, we would use the computers and we'd use the software. If you're talking about the actual printing stuff, that was done by University of Oregon Printing and Mailing, but we paid them for it.
Okay.
So. But that's what I mean by drive. I mean, like, I literally just had the idea, and it was something that it was one of those ones that really hooked me. And then all of a sudden, I was just like, okay, time to run a magazine. I didn't really, you know, I had read comics and stuff like that, but I never, you know, run a magazine. So I was just like, I'm going to pretend like I know what I'm doing and then hopefully
make it
that works.
You make it.
Yeah. So
sounds like you made it pretty well.
Yeah, no, it worked out pretty well. And that doesn't happen with all the projects I start, but it happens with a couple of them. That's, I guess, drive, unique, just go out and be like, all right, time to do it. That's also how I actually write. It's not like I'm, like, struck by a muse. I literally have a sheet of ideas, and I'm like, all right, it's time to write, and I'll just start writing, and I'll start writing, and even if it's not good, I just keep writing until I have a song. And then I'm like, cool, I have a song.
I was not to compare you, But to compare you to, I was listening to you the other day because I saw your show the other last week or so.
Right.
And it's the very witty banter in your songs that is likened to, Bo Burnham or Dimitri Martin does some of those kind of things. It's that kind of like really witty, quick, you may miss a joke. There's so many little ones stuck in there. I was really impressed. It was awesome.
Oh, thank you.
So you do that, just like sit down and I'm going to put these 9 ideas together into a song? Or?
Yeah. So the way it, the writing process, the way it starts, the most recent song I wrote, the idea for the song was, I thought it'd be funny to do a song of you clog a toilet, you flush it. Now it's a race until the water falls onto the floor and you have to figure out how to plunge it. And so I was just like, well, that's the funny part. That's the meat of the idea. How do I get to it? And then I was like, okay, let's do a story. And it was just basically, hey, you're at a party. You go, you use the restroom. You had Taco Bell.
Right.
That's what's going to happen. You clog the toilet. Time to find a plunger. You can't seem to find a plunger.
Because it's not your home.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, whatever, I'll flush it. You realize it's going to spill out. Oh, you need to go and grab a plunger. You finally see the plunger, and now it's a race. And then I finally connect it to that idea. But then of course, you know, you go out, and then you realize, because you were in a rush, because you were, like, plunging so much, you got shit water all over yourself. And that's, like, the final...
The real dig.
Yeah, the final kicker. And it's a country song. All my jokes about poop and toilets are country songs.
That's you keep it that way on purpose?
I don't keep it that way on purpose. That's just kind of how it happens. I was just like, yeah, this is going to be a country song, I guess.
Most of my songs about drinking are country songs.
Yeah. Drinking and toilets are very
similar. Because I tend to, you know, sit in the backyard with the guitar and drink for 2 hours while writing a song, and that's how it ends up.
Yeah.
Although I tend to just grab ideas out of the air.
Right.
Or start with one simple concept. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's not too different that it compiles on itself.
Yeah.
But I like your drive that you see the end goal in this case and then tackle how to get there and then put a big hook on the end of it.
Yeah, that's the... I mean, I'm fairly, like, formulaic. I'm fairly organized when it comes to it. I've got, like, a Google Drive. It's nicely organized. It's like a little... I have a list of every single idea I have. And yet, some ideas are easier to flesh out than others. Sometimes I just have to, like... I've been doing this for about a year, and I've written, like, about 33 songs. In the beginning, it was really, really
tough.
That's
a good output for any songwriter.
Yeah.
But one that's focused on doing it comedically, that's incredible output.
Thank you. And because I've just done it so much, I can now just kind of sit down... And my first draft will usually be pretty much my last draft because I'm just like, okay, this is going to be a story type song. And then there are other kinds of songs where it's just like, I don't even know what to call them. Just drilling the concept into someone's head. I have a song called "Nothing Says Fuck You Like a Gift Card to Rite Aid."
Exactly the one I was thinking.
Yeah,
of.
And that
I
is
laughed
just
so hard.
And that's just like. It's just a hilarious concept, and I'm just like, okay, time to, like, take this concept, play with it. And then there's the, I've written enough to the point where, like, I kind of know how I like to write songs, and now it's just, like, I have a concept. It typically will fit into, like, some sort of form of, you know, songwriting I've written, and then I just write it out. I even have, like, a specific rhyming scheme that I always use. I always write 4 lines. The first line will not rhyme with anything. The second line will always rhyme with the fourth line. And then the third line is also not going to rhyme with anything. It's the rhyming scheme I typically use. It's the one I'm most comfortable with. It's fairly easy to write because it's less rhyming, which is sometimes essential for comedy songs. And then the other one I will write is like one where like all 4 lines will like rhyme together, which I don't like to do as much because
it's a
lot.
It's a good word challenge. You know?
Typically, as weird as this sounds, the song will usually tell me how it wants to sound as I'm writing it, and it will tell me if it wants to, like, rhyme a certain specific way. This sounds cheesy and corny, but I don't, like, really write the songs or the ideas. I kind of just kind of listen to the concept and, like, try to figure out what it wants to be. And then I go through and I edit it to make sure that, oh, this could be a little bit funnier this way, this could be a little bit funnier that way.
I can totally identify with that. Although most of my songs, there's a couple humorous ones, but most of my songs are more emotionally driven, and so I'm trying to remove the comedy sometimes and reach more into the darkness.
Gotcha.
But I totally identify. It's a very similar thing. Process for me in, when I'm writing songs is to let the song kind of tell me what it wants to be.
I think also the fact that I write comedy songs is the fact why it's been so easy. Because everything in my life, no matter what I do, it always ends up being funny. And I can't not have it be funny. It's just like, it's how it goes. And so I just kind of lean into it. And now it's just like, okay, sure. I'm sure I could write drama if I really wanted to, but it's way too much work. And I'm not about that. I'm not going to put in a bunch of work to write a bad drama when I could, you know, put in a little effort and write a pretty good comedy.
That's actually a good balance.
Yeah.
That's like a good thing to realize about yourself.
Yeah. That being said, comedy can be in itself serious. In that, you can make fun of something that is just like something incredibly terrible. And the joke, of course, being, look at this terrible thing. It's happening. It's still happening. That's hilarious.
It has to have a touchstone to reality. Yeah. That's what drives comedy home for most people. And it's oftentimes, I don't know if it's maybe just comedians that I like, but they're touching on something in society that is kind of dark.
Yeah.
And that we can all identify with, but doing it in a way that makes it easier to swallow at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
But still brings your attention to it.
Yeah. I don't have a good example of a song that does that. I typically stay away from controversial stuff or stuff that I think is like, ooh, this might make people upset. I don't think it's just like something I don't want to do, I guess.
Is there a reason why, or is it just
the spot
that you're working in right now? I mean,
honestly, it sounds bad, but it's mostly fear. I don't want people to get angry at me. I don't want to deal with it, and that's pretty much it. I'm just like, all right, you're gonna get angry at me if I say this. I'm just not gonna say it, and you know, it's just not wanting to be yelled at.
That's fair. I mean, it's not everybody is Lenny Bruce.
Yeah.
You know, thank heavens, because we don't need a couple of years of just reading out your jail sentences.
Yeah,
come on. The last couple of years were pretty bad. Something else, but pretty bad. So, next question is. And always, there are a lot of them come up before I ask the question, but it is, will you tell me about a defining moment? This has a pause button.
I'll take a pause. I need to think about this for a second. So, I had the defining moment, and I realized I should have probably told you what I was about to do. The defining moment is specifically when I wrote my first comedy song in the ukulele called Bobby and Susie. I can actually just play it for you, and then I can kind of explain why it's a defining moment and why it's so important.
I'm into that. Let's do it. Right. Let's do it. I'll watch the levels and see how badly we go.
I'll do a test and run.
Who knows?
Oh, this is my ukulele, Josuke. I have two of them.
Josuke?
Josuke. He is a character from an anime that I like. Anime is a Japanese cartoon, just in case.
Mine's name is Lilo. Wait, it has an onboard tuning?
Yep.
That's pretty cool.
Walking in a park, walking in a park, walking in a park. Bobby and Susie were walking in a park. They were holding hands. Bobby gave Susie a big old kiss, a big old kiss, a big old kiss. Bobby gave Susie a big old kiss, and boy, did it feel good. Bobby's scrotum began to fill with blood, fill with blood, Bobby's scrotum began to fill with blood. Bobby had a visible erection. Susie's vagina began to self-lubricate. 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 Susie's vagina began to self-lubricate. Susie was aroused. They went over to Susie's house. Susie's house. Susie's house. They went over to Susie's house. Susie's parents were not home. Bobby and Susie were making out naked, making out naked, making out naked. Bobby and Susie were making out naked. Bobby wanted to go forward. But Susie had some reservations, reservations, reservations. Susie had some reservations. Years of social stigma towards women's sexuality was subconsciously getting to her.
That's that lady stuff I was talking about.
Bobby began to bitch and moan. Bitch and moan. Bitch and moan. Bobby began to bitch and moan. It wasn't what you'd call a turn on. Bobby settled for a hand job. A hand job. A hand job. Bobby settled for a hand job. He didn't enjoy his orgasm. Then there was an awkward silence.
All right.
Yeah. So that was the first song I ever wrote.
Thank you. That is the very first ever musical interlude on this. This is awesome. So why was it a defining moment?
So it was a defining moment for a couple reasons. First off, it was defining a moment and it made me realize that I could do comedy songs. More importantly, it kind of touched on an issue I think myself and a lot of young men have, you know, dealt with throughout their life, which is, you know, how much it is hammered into you that sex, it's sex that's what's important. If it wasn't, you know, penis and vagina, it didn't count. And it was after I wrote that song that I went, well, that's not exactly right. That's actually really unhealthy and kind of problematic. And so it was after, like, I had written that song that I, like, when you play video games and, like, all of a sudden you, like, you level up and you get to see your stats. It was after I wrote that song and after I had made that realization, I was like, you've leveled up as a person. You've learned how to empathize with women. Do-do-do-do-do. And I was like, oh, cool.
Select your now power.
Okay. Yeah. And that was the real, like, you know, defining moment. I was really proud of it because I was like, oh, wow. Oh, you know, because, you know, I've been like, you know, I had always like seen like sex as like the really big important thing. And then it was after I'd written that song, I was just like, hand jobs are great. Why?
Nothing wrong with
why, hand why job. Am I, why am I upset if I don't end up having sex?
Where do you think that idea came from?
I mean, for me personally, I know that it came from movies and TV. And, you know, other kids. In a weird way, it also came from sex ed classes.
Yeah.
Because they really, really
hype on. They don't have that figured out yet. Oddly, you'd think, by now.
Yeah, it was just like, because they were always, like, you know, constantly, like, saying, oh, you know, here's what you do for, you know, protected sex and this and sex and that. And it was just like, yeah, I don't know. It was more of, like, It's the fact that, you know, as a kid, you're like, oh, man, after you have sex, you're a man. That's the key to becoming a man. And it's like the fact that, you know, putting a penis inside a vagina is supposed to be like this amazing and wonderful experience, which it is. Yeah.
It is. Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, it's awesome, but there's like a billion other things that you can do that are going to end in the same that don't require...
I'm an onomatopoeic version of semen.
Yeah. Is that not what it sounds like for you? Should I see a doctor? Anyway. And it was... And then it was just like... Then I kind of came to terms with, oh... You don't need sex to say that you're a man. You don't need... to put, you know, a penis in a vagina to have any sort of self-worth. And that's when I kind of, like, removed my self-worth from the amount of, sex that I was having. That was a really big, important step for me.
It sounds like you were shaking off some masculinity.
Yeah, exactly.
Some societal masculinity shit.
Yeah, societal masculinity, mostly because I think enjoying a hand job is more masculine than just being like, oh, I didn't get to have sex kind of thing.
Well, not to mention, I mean... It's allowing other people to work within their own limits and levels, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Instead of enforcing your weird preconceived notion into their shit.
Yeah.
We all got shit, man.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that it, started for me was, you know, being able to empathize more. And just being able to realize there are things that, you know, you might do that will make people feel uncomfortable. And it's always a good idea to, you know, keep that in the back of your mind. And to also realize if someone's making you uncomfortable, to speak up. So that was a defining moment for that, most of that reason. And the other reason, of course, being, hey, you know how to write comedy songs. Because that song literally just wrote itself. I literally just went to the computer and just typed it out in one go. Which typically is a good sign that, oh, it's going to be a good song.
Yeah, yeah. Something comes out just almost vomit-like. It can be just really good. Yeah.
I remember when I was first writing, I'd spent like 2 or 3 weeks writing this one song called Cheese and Carbs, which was just like, you know, just saying, oh, man, I love cheese.
Which is also a callback to an earlier conversation.
Yeah, exactly. Of just how great cheese is and like saying, oh, I love cheese and carbs. And it took me a while, and it wasn't. It's fine. It's an okay song. It's kind of funny. It'll make you smile. And then right after that, I had this idea for a song called "Cycle of Abuse,"
Pretty dark topic.
One second.
Oh well, let's record this one after.
Oh okay, sure. Yeah, sure. It's mostly an answering to the dark part, because once you hear it, you realize, maybe it's not so dark. Are you sure you don't want me to play it?
I'm sure. We'll record it.
Okay.
That's the one we'll do as the outro.
Okay, sure.
As we discuss. Because, spoilers. Oh, well. We're going to change up the theme a little bit this
week.
It's going to be fun. But it's interesting, the dark. I just listened to an interview with Chuck Palahniuk. And talk about visiting the dark and answering to the dark. I mean, that man. Are you familiar with who he is?
I am not.
Wrote Fight Club.
Oh, okay.
Choke.
Okay.
And some of these really brutal... You know, looks at society and the way that society works, and he's just a fascinating man. But looking at the dark, I think it's important.
Yeah.
Through whatever window you want to do it through. So, you want to knock out the last question?
Sure, sounds good.
Okay. What makes you similar to other people?
Oh, this is the exact opposite of the last question, I see. Well, I feel many other people are also 3 cats in a trench coat. Rapping.
to bring it
all the way back. I think a lot of people also don't know what they're doing, but pretend to know what they're doing. And that's what makes me similar. Because do I know what I'm doing? I mean, I can pretend like I do, and that works. And I think a lot of other people are just kind of pretending like they know what they do. And I think that's what generally will make me similar to other people. For the whole big philosophical thing. Like many other people, I don't like raw tomatoes.
I'm sorry.
Really?
I'll have your share.
Do you like raw tomatoes?
Love them.
It's a texture thing. Honestly, I have legitimately tried eating raw tomatoes now and then. I'm just like, I can't do it. I got to.
My thing is beets. I've tried and tried and tried and tried and nope. Yeah. I'll eat the greens, but somebody else got to eat the beet.
Okay. I'm not a huge fan of beets either. I think it's a flavor thing on that one specifically.
It's a curious thing.
Yeah. Some people love them. I'm just
pretty
like,
color.
Yeah.
Like, I'll take that. The tomato thing, I know a number of people in your tomato camp.
Yeah, you're right.
So it is definitely something that makes you similar to other people.
Let's see. What else? I think I'm just going to go with, like, generally the better format is to go really silly and then philosophical and then end with the philosophical thing. But I already did the whole people are just kind of don't know what they're doing pretending thing, and now I just kind of went back into, like, the silliness.
Well, it's true, though. People... I think that is kind of a general human truth, that at some point and in some way, everyone is just kind of faking something.
Yeah.
They're trying to make it through. Whether they are dealing with a really exciting situation and trying to do it with some kind of reserve and reason instead of making an insane decision, or if they're struggling with a hard situation and just trying to show up at work and do the job, man.
Yeah.
You're faking it in some way.
Yeah.
I think that is kind of a common societal trait. I would totally agree with you on that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's going to be my answer. I can't think of anything else that makes me, like, you know, similar to... I mean, like most Americans, I struggle with obesity. There's that.
Well, we're offered this wonderful dietary system here in America and not taught how to eat well in our youth. And... Yeah.
And also, like, foods are good and then bad for you. Yeah. No. I mean, like butter used to be, like, bad for you, and now it's good for you, but coconut oil is no longer bad for you now, so it's just, like...
It's just whatever, you know, whatever the science is being chased right now.
Yeah.
And you gotta have a certain amount of salt, but not too much salt, and this oil, not that oil, and avocado fat is good, but other fat isn't good. Like, oh, come on, man.
Which is why I just kind of eat what I like to eat and just kind of like try to eat in moderation and try to get exercise.
Well, it sounds like you're also letting your body decide a little bit right now.
Yeah, pretty much.
Hence, you're moving to the vegetarian world.
Yeah, that was more of a body thing. And also, vegetables are surprisingly delicious.
Vegetables are fucking delicious, with the exception of beets.
Yeah.
And maybe raw tomatoes.
Raw tomatoes, beets. I was going to say pineapple, but pineapple's a fruit.
A fruit.
Yeah.
Really? Don't do pineapple?
I just can't get past the flavor. It's there's something about it that I'm just like if you were like, Alex, eat this bowl of pineapple or you'll die, I'll be like, okay, cool. And I wouldn't gag.
Or eat this pineapple and you'll die, in which case you're JonBenet Ramsey.
Yeah.
I don't know if you knew, but that was one of the things they found in her stomach after she died.
Wow, really?
Yeah, pineapple.
Huh.
Yeah.
Sure.
Read a lot and listen to a lot on true crime and so dumb shit like that. Gotcha. On occasion. Sorry.
No, that's cool. I just didn't know who JonBenet Ramsey was.
Oh, she's a young... Oh, shit. You're going to have to look it up. I'll let you look it up.
All right.
I'm not going to waste time explaining to the world this. But it was a little girl who was in beauty pageants who ended up being killed. And it's an unsolved case. And it's globally renowned for idiots who follow true crime like me.
Gotcha. Okay.
So, on that, I think that's probably a podcast.
All right, sounds good.
Thank you so much for doing it, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was super fun.
Thanks. It's going to be keep going fun, because it's going to be even more fun after this.
Yeah, did you want me to do the...
Let me press stop, and I'll break it up.
Okay.
And as I mentioned in the spoiler... near the end of the episode, here is the other song that Alex played for us in lieu of our normal outro music. Enjoy. We'll talk to you next week.
All right. And go.
Oh, the cycle of abuse goes round and round, round and round, round and round. The cycle of abuse goes round and round all the livelong day. Martin, he is the big boss, but he's pissed off, so he yells at Josh. Josh then goes to a coffee shop and yells at a barista. The barista is now in a bad mood, as as a result, doesn't serve good food. This pisses off a woman named Jude, who is Martin's wife. Jude goes home and takes off her sock, tells Martin he has a small cock. Martin cannot handle the shock and yells at people next day. Oh, the cycle of abuse goes round and round, round and round, round and round. The cycle of abuse goes round and round all the live long day.